Hello, welcome to this week's Boxing News podcast, The Opening Bell. I'm editor Tris Dixon, joined once again by Matt Christie. Matt, how are things going out there?
It's a wet and miserable day in London, but I've got a smile on my face, which is the important thing.
What's put the smile there?
Just life in general, Tris.
You're just happy.
I'm just happy.
So on Friday, you're going to go see someone down in your neck of the woods in Brighton, aren't you?
Yeah, I've arranged to go and interview Ronnie Davis, who was the man rather rudely ousted from the ring at the weekend when the board official went into Chris Eubank Jr.'s corner and said there was only 1 second allowed to be inside the ring during that minute interval. And there was two, the other being Chris Eubank Sr., who at the time was not talking, he was just posing and doing what Chris Eubank does well, and that was gathering attention. So I'll be speaking to him about that, about the progress of Eubank Jr., and also hoping to tell the story of the man Ronnie Davis, who has often been ignored in the background and in the shadows.
What do you make of that dynamic? What do you think it is about Ronnie Davis that the Eubanks, that attracts the Eubanks? Because you know, with their name and their celebrity, they could go anywhere feasibly, couldn't they? Well, we know they've been to the Mayweather gym sparring and here, there.
Yeah, I think Ronnie is perhaps a little bit, you know, he understated would be the wrong word, but he will allow, he knows the Eubanks, he's known Chris Jr. for 20 years, he's known Chris Sr. for far more than that, he was there from the beginning, he knows their strengths and he knows their weaknesses in terms of their characters. He knows that they enjoy being in the limelight. He allows that. He doesn't wish to steal away any of that limelight. And ultimately, he's a very, very knowledgeable boxing man.
Okay. Interesting stuff. Be fascinated to find out how you get on Friday. Should he attend? Because he wasn't there last time you went to see him, was he?
No, he was actually up in Liverpool for Eubank Jr.'s latest fight. So we missed each other at that time, but hopefully he'll be there this time on Friday. I'm going round to his house. I've got his home address, so there should be no escape this time.
Okay. All right. Last weekend, Matt, was an action-packed weekend. There were big fights pretty much everywhere. Let's start with Randy Caballero against Stuart Hall. Hall, for me, one of Britain's most underrated and probably underappreciated fighters. Had a brief spell as a world champion, still looks to be a world-level operator, but Randy Caballero just had a bit too much. His sort of left hooks to the body and thudding hooks inside, I thought, were more accurate over the 12-round distance against Stuart Hall. But Hall, having lost, like I said, he's at world level, but it's very rare you get a world title shot just after losing one. So where would you like to see Stuart Hall go next?
I mean, there's still plenty of options. I think he's proved, perhaps more so in defeat recently, really, against Caballero, that he is at world level and has proved, and in the Paul Butler fight as well, perhaps proved more in those defeats than he did in victory. I mean, I felt a bit sorry for Stuart Hall. He was kind of swept up in kind of the hangover of the controversy of Jerry McDonnell losing or being stripped of the title. Hall was an unfair victim of that, really, when he picked up the vacant crown. And also, these guys down, it's really, you know, it takes an exceptional character, an exceptional fighter, really, to break out from those divisions and be a household name. Stuart Hall,
Channel 5 audience would have helped.
Well, this definitely will have helped. This definitely will have helped his profile. And he's also got that great backstory, hasn't he, where he's misbehaved quite a lot in Ibiza and everything else and kind of got his life back on track with the help of boxing. But at 34, how much longer has he got left? Okay, he hasn't been in the game that long, but by all accounts, he didn't look after his body that well beforehand.
And the fights with the likes of Vusi Malinga, Paul Butler, and now Caballero, they're draining fights, aren't they?
Yeah, you don't see these smaller guys going into their mid-30s and beyond necessarily operating at their peak. But very, I'm sure now a rematch with Jamie McDonnell would be very, very appealing to fans and the fighters alike. Although Jamie McDonnell now, presuming he gets past Alberto Ramos in November, is set to head off to Las Vegas for a shot at the title there.
What I thought was interesting about the Hall Caballero fight was that Stuart Hall remarkably had a 12-inch reach advantage.
Yeah.
But he still fought in close. He obviously said that before the fight, when I spoke to him for the preview, he was saying that he was reborn, rejuvenated under the new trainer Paddy Lynch, and he'd been training hard in Birmingham. But tactically, when you look at Hall, he's got a useful double jab and right hand. He can keep things long if he needs to. Do you think he fought the wrong fight by going in the pocket with Caballero and fighting toe-to-toe with him? Or do you think he should have used his natural advantages in height and reach to try and keep him at bay?
No, absolutely. Perhaps he should have done. Perhaps, you know, that was what he was trying to do in a way. I think for what we've said about Hall, and Hall has certainly achieved a lot more than many thought capable, but is he still perhaps slightly limited in that area, in that can he go out and fight long? He's done it to an extent at domestic level, but you know, his success has come through his tenacity and fighting hard and hoping that he's fighting harder than his opponent.
Now, also on that bill in Monte Carlo, and we had a long ringside report from Deck Warrington, Martin Murray fought Domenico Spada, and he's now got the poison chalice of a fight with Gennady Golovkin in February, back in Monte Carlo. Now, I don't want to sound like I'm hating on Martin Murray, because I'm certainly not, who I think is, you know, he's proved to be a world-class operator in his fights to Felix Sturm, a draw in Germany, and his away challenge in Argentina of Sergio Martinez. He's proved where he belongs. But Gennady Golovkin, I mean, price it up for me, Matt. Golovkin-Murray.
Murray, you would say at least 7-1 underdog, I would imagine.
At least 7-1, yeah. I'd say that's fair enough, and that's not a criticism of Murray.
No.
You know what, some of the bookies here on Odds Checker, you can get 10-1 on Martin Murray to beat Golovkin. And that speaks volumes about Golovkin, who's the consensus is he's 1-16 on. It speaks more about Golovkin than it does Murray, though, doesn't it?
Yeah, completely. I also think that the guys that Golovkin has been walking right through recently, like Macklin, like Marco Antonio Rubio, like Daniel Gill, can you really make an argument that Murray is that far above them? And I think that's why the odds are probably equally as long against Martin to score the upset.
You know, Golovkin's obviously become big business in the US. You know, he drew a crowd of around 10,000 to Los Angeles the other day. HBO are backing him. He could be going on pay-per-view next year. What is it that he's done that has got people so excited and buzzing about him? Because it's not who he's beaten, is it?
No, it's not who he's beaten. It's the manner. It's the manner of the victories. And it does bring to mind the Mike Tyson, when he, you know, roared onto the scene and he was knocking guys out like Marvis Frazier before he won the title in a fashion that, you know, was frightening. And then he beat the likes of Trevor Burbick, Pinklin Thomas, Tyrell Biggs. None of them were particularly fearsome fighters that were thought to have a chance against Tyson, but it was the frightening one-sided manner in which he was getting rid of these guys. And you know, Golovkin walking through Macklin to me was a real eye-opener. Macklin, as tough as they come, who'd gone 12 tough rounds with Felix Sturm, with Sergio Martinez, and Golovkin walked through him like it was nothing.
Well, the finish against Daniel Gill was exceptional, wasn't it? Because he took a clean right hand and basically knocked him out in the same split second.
Yeah, exactly. And it's what fans really, really like. It's the kind of thrills and spills from one-sided maulings that can really seduce a casual fan and make them a hardcore fan.
Mm, interesting. Golovkin then, say he does overcome Murray, and obviously the odds are stacked against Martin Murray. Plan out his next two fights So say he's going to fight. I'd imagine he's going to fight three times in 2014. And 2015, and I can only envisage one of them being a big fight.
Yeah, I would imagine the final fight is likely to be against the Cotto Alvarez winner, isn't it? So Murray is looking likely for February 21. You would then think that Golovkin would be out again in the summer.
But who would you pair him with?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, perhaps Khorabov Andy Lee winner, I think, would be an interesting fight, which you'd have to pick Khorabov to beat Andy Lee, I think. I think Khorabov would be favourite. Khorabov, vastly talented amateur, hasn't quite fulfilled that promise. But if he looks really good against Andy Lee, I think you've got some justification for making that fight against Khorabov.
Okay.
Two titles as well on the line, so when he goes in against the Cotto Alvarez winner, it's for all the bacon.
Yeah, okay, I see that. If you, who's the one guy who can stop Golovkin? You know, when you mentioned the Tyson connection, and in fact Nigel Collins in his guest column this week has mentioned a sort of connection between Golovkin and Pacquiao, or the Pacquiao of a few years ago. Who's the roadblock out there? Who's the Buster Douglas? Who's the Evander Holyfield? Or the Marquez? Who's the guy who's going to stop this trail of destruction?
I mean, Buster Douglas was very much an unknown quantity, wasn't he? That came like a bolt out of the blue, so perhaps Martin Murray is the Buster Douglas. But someone who we might expect to fare better against Golovkin would be Andre Ward. Looking at it without delving too deep, it's an interesting fight. It's a fight that they both need. You could also make the argument that Golovkin is perhaps too small for that fight. But with the power he was shown at middleweight, you would think that he would be able to transfer the majority of it up to 168 pounds, and the clash of styles would be fascinating. And, you know, both of them are crying out for a fight at that level. I think we can forget about Floyd Mayweather moving up to middleweight and taking on Golovkin.
What about Golovkin said, or his people told us last week, that Golovkin could go down to 154 for Mayweather?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure that would be a brilliant move.
Who wins?
If he goes down to 154, I'd probably tentatively pick Floyd Mayweather. I don't think it does fighters much good at all when they go down. Even if they've been there for large parts of their career, when they've then operated in a higher weight class, it's very, very rare that a move down in weight ends well.
Yeah, okay, interesting. We had that actually years and years ago when Eddie Mustafa Muhammad dabbled at heavyweight and then had to lose weight to get back down to light heavyweight to fight Michael Spinks.
Yeah.
And he had to do it in a relatively short space of time. He was just never the same fighter after that.
Yeah.
You're right, it does happen. But interesting fights out there for Golovkin, for sure. Let's hope we can get those matches made. And I mean, a couple that I'd love to see Golovkin have, certainly after Martin Murray, should he come through that, would be against the likes of Mikel Kessler and Karl Froch.
Yeah, again, I mean, that's where the danger really lies, isn't it, for Golovkin, if he goes out of his natural habitat, if he leaves the middleweight division where he's proven to be the most fearsome there. But if he does step up in weight, there's always going to be those question marks. Can he cope with that extra weight? Can he cope with the heavier guys? But yeah, Froch Golovkin, particularly for me, is one of the most mouth-watering fights to be made in boxing at the moment.
Interesting stuff. Also in Monte Carlo, there was a win for South African star Hecky Budler, a loss for his compatriot Rhino Liebenberg, the first defeat of his career against Elidio Alvarez. Alvarez definitely one to watch in an interesting division now at light heavyweight, where you've got Adonis Stevenson, Sergey Kovalev, and Artur Babertyev. Interestingly, I am out there working on the preview for Hopkins Kovalev, and I tell you what, although I've liked the fight since it was made, I can't remember being more split in a preview than I am at the minute. I mean, where would you go? Where's your money at the moment?
I certainly wouldn't want to be laying too much money on it. I can't imagine the odds are going to be that tempting to lay it one way or the other, unless you were to...
Well, do you know what? Hopkins generally a 5-2 underdog, and Kovalev 2-5 on favourite. The draw at 25-1.
you can understand fully those odds. Draw, you would suggest, is unlikely, as it always is, hence the long odds, but you know, it's not particularly tempting here. Hopkins, it's hard not to talk about Hopkins without mentioning his age, but surely that is a factor. It's got to be a factor, and Kovalev really has been an absolute destroyer. But we've seen it so many times before with Hopkins. He's surprised us so many times, which is why I think if I was to watch yet another Hopkins masterclass, it wouldn't for me be an upset of the year.
I'm looking at the most popular bets on Oddschecker, and they're pretty much split. There's just a very small fragment of people going for the draw, but the rest is sort of about, looks to be about 50% going for Hopkins, maybe 48% going Kovalev. Obviously at 50% Hopkins, looking at the bigger odds, the 5-2. I mean, what's interesting about the fight is the psychological aspect of it for me, and this is what I've been wrestling with this morning. What's interesting is Kovalev has intimidated a lot of people into defeat, and as we were talking about Golovkin there, you know, the knockout ratio sort of goes hand in hand with the fear factor that becomes associated with these people, Tyson too. So Kovalev's now getting into the ring, and people are thinking, geez, what have I let myself in for? Obviously, not only will Bernard Hopkins not be thinking that, because that's not how Bernard Hopkins operates, what happens to Kovalev when someone like Evander Holyfield stood up to Mike Tyson, looks down at him and thinks, I've been there, I've done it, I've done it all. You know, you're not showing me anything new. How does that affect Kovalev's psyche?
It's got to affect his psyche, particularly in battle. It's got to, and I suspect that is a scenario that they've prepared heavily for in training. The biggest argument you can make for Hopkins to win this fight, I think, is the fact that he's never lost to a fighter like Kovalev. Kind of echoing what you're just saying there, he'll get in the ring, he'll have perhaps have seen it all before. Whether he'll have felt power like that, or whether he'll have felt power like that for, it's a long time. And let's also remember that this is Kovalev's natural weight class. When he beat Trinidad, you could argue that Trinidad was better in the smaller weights. You could argue that because Pavlik had moved up in weight as well to take on Hopkins. So this is Kovalev hitting at his hardest. Also, the other thing as well is Hopkins is absolutely brilliant. He's engrossing when he talks, he's funny, but also you would imagine he's hard really to deal with as an opponent. But Kovalev, okay, it might sound an obvious thing to say or whatever, but you know, English is not Kovalev's first language. He'll probably find it a lot easier to switch off when Hopkins' motor mouth gets going and just ignore what Hopkins is saying and not let it drill into his psyche, which undoubtedly he did with the likes of Kelly Pavlik, with, you know, the
Tavoris Clouds, yeah, who weren't the same again.
Yeah.
Interesting. And then there was a big fight in Liverpool last weekend, or a big bill in Liverpool, massive bill, come to think of it. I remember looking at Facebook at about 1 o'clock in the morning, and John Dennen, who was ringside for us, said there's big wins for Kevin Satchel, Paul Butler, Chris Eubank Jr., Derry Matthews, and a string of others. And then there was almost a few dots, and then it said, and the show's still going on.
Yeah.
So massive bill. What caught your eye from Liverpool?
The Liverpool show, I mean, I watched it. I did thoroughly enjoy it, to be honest with you. But the main thing that caught my eye was a bit further down the bill, and that was Jack Cattrall virtually... I mean, it looked like he was going to walk straight through Tom Stalker in two or three rounds. It was the ease of how he was doing it, how Stalker really had no answers for it. I mean, Stalker, to his credit, after taking an absolute battering in the first two rounds, did get back into the fight. Never looked like he was going to win it, but he got back into the fight and he won a couple of rounds during the middle section of that fight. I thought Stalker deserved credit for that. But then Cattrall came back and, you know, no qualms with the stoppage. It was shockingly one-sided.
Also shockingly one-sided was Chris Eubank Jr., unsurprisingly, against Omar Siala. But it was that one-sided, and he looked that devastating that I'm sure there were many people that thought, if he lands those sort of shots on Billy Joe Saunders, it's going to be a really good night, an interesting night.
Yeah, I mean, it's that Billy Joe Saunders fight. We spoke about it at length in the office on the podcast, and it is, you know, unquestionably, I think the most anticipated domestic fight this year.
You think so? Do you think more than Bellew Cleverly, more than Fury?
I think he's got the intrigue.
He certainly can't be more than Frotch Groves.
Okay, but yeah, okay, no, that's
come
true.
On, get realistic. No, are you working for the promoters on the side?
Okay, at this level, at British title level, it certainly is. And, you know, but if Eubank Jr., because at the same time, yeah, he was unloading some eye-catching shots.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you can imagine that Billy Joe Saunders isn't going to be in a, he's not just going to stand there and take those shots either. He's going to be a lot cuter, he's going to be a lot smarter, and he's obviously a lot better than what was in front of Eubank Jr. on Saturday. But you know, I mean, while I was confirming this Friday's meeting with Ronnie Davis, you know, Ronnie reiterated to me last night just how he is absolutely 100% convinced that Eubank Jr. is gonna walk through Billy Joe Saunders. He says that Eubank Jr. is already at a level now in terms of fitness and mental confidence that Billy Joe Saunders will have to work exceptionally hard to get anywhere close to between now and the fight.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's all set up. I mean, you know, when you're calling fights and when you're trying to predict fights, you have to go with what you've seen. It's a riskier business when you predict a fight just based on potential, which is what you would be doing if you were to pick Chris Eubank Jr. to beat Billy Joe Saunders. But it's almost a feeling that's kind of bubbling away underneath it, whether this is just written in the stars that Chris Eubank Jr. will do to Billy Joe Saunders what his dad did to Nigel Benn.
That he has that sort of massive launch pad to take
exactly
him to the next level.
And if he will just perform above and beyond what we've seen before, and he will fight at Billy Joe Saunders' level and then go two or three above that.
Remind you at all of anything to like when Cal Zaghi fought Eubank Senior?
It's a good comparison, but no.
it's good, but it's not right.
It hadn't until.
I mean, obviously, Eubank was very much a veteran, you know, former world champ and all the rest of it, and very much on the downside, which you can't say that about Billy Joe. But I suppose it's that leap of faith, isn't it, that Joe Calzaghe took against Chris Eubank's Jr.'s father, that Chris Eubank Jr. is now about to take.
Yeah, exactly.
It's that leap, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
That leap into the unknown. And I think what I've deduced my time calling fights is that the more questions you have to ask about the fight, the better the fight is.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is one of those where there's so many questions. You know, is Billy Joe too experienced? Is he too slick? Is he too good? Or is Eubank, you know, what's Eubank got? You know, is he as good as everyone's been making out from sparring? You know, there's like a dozen questions that come to mind about the fight straight away before you even start any analysis. And that's good. And I think you've got that with Hopkins, Kovalev too. You know, so many, you know, will Hopkins get old overnight? Is Kovalev a complete destroyer when you hear these stories that Golovkin manhandled him in sparring a while ago? So many questions, you know, it's just, it's the unknown, and that's what we have with Frotch and Groves. And I think that's what, for me, sells a fight, is if a match is made and instantly your head's filled with questions. And I think, to be fair, Bellew Cleverly's got that as well. You know, Cleverly seems to be more dented and more harmed by his defeat to Kovalev than Bellew does to his from Stevenson. Obviously, it's still in Liverpool, but Bellew's built a very strong fan base there now. He's obviously had wider exposure and is better known now than he was at the time, I'd venture to suggest. Cleverly, people saying his heart's not really in it. He trained with Adam Booth. He's now training back in Wales. You know, is he really keyed up for it? And obviously, like I said, it's these fights where there's so many question marks around them. They're the ones that really sort of pull me in, because it's when the bell goes, you know, that's when you get all the answers, don't you?
No, you do, you do. But I just think you mentioned there Bellew Cleverly, and you mentioned, you know, various other examples. But with the question marks, I think they're heightened. They're almost at a level which you know, you only experience maybe once a year in boxing, I think. And, you know, you almost talked yourself into picking Tony Bellew there. I suspect you would, whichever way you were to pick in that rematch, you would be more confident than you would be in this Eubank Billy Joe Saunders
prediction. Yeah, you're probably right.
The other thing as well is what the trainers are saying. I mentioned what Ronnie Davis is saying about Eubank Jr. You're also on the other side, you've got Jimmy Tibbs, who is saying that Billy Joe Saunders, and he's been saying it, you know, for such a long time now, that this kid is the most gifted guy he's ever worked with. And that's coming from Tibbs, who has worked with some of the best guys this country has produced over the last 20 or 30 years.
Yeah.
So they've both got absolute faith in their charges, which all just makes it can't miss, doesn't it?
Great mixing pot. Okay, also on that Liverpool bill, by the way, obviously we talked briefly there about Chris Eubank Jr. and his fight on November the 29th. Paul Butler, again, impressed against Ismael Garnica. And Derry Matthews, I mean, goodness me, what a career Derry Matthews has had. He's, you know, some people thought that Adam Dingsdale not only would give him a tough night, but could actually beat him. Well, Derry's chalked off another one. It's one of those for Derry. I mean, he's lost fights he should have won, won fights he was expected to lose. But one thing, you know, you just can't take him lightly, and you can't write him off. Write him off at your peril, that's for sure. So big stuff in Liverpool. And there was also a big night in Hull. Not sure what you've seen of the action. For me, I mean, it was great to see the scenes of Tommy Coyle in his corner being massively excited, and then him and Luke Campbell talking in the ring, talking up their fight. But massively sad when you see a servant to boxing like Michael Katsidis put out to pasture the way that he was. You think of his fights, not just the Graham Earl fight, but against Juan Diaz. Who was the Asian boxer he fought? Was Sir Ayman Sot as well, who had complications after that fight. Katsidis has been in some really rough nights, and in fact, I don't think he was the same again after Robert Guerrero absolutely annihilated him. I think that was on the Marcos Maidana, Eric Morales one bill. Guerrero just completely bashed him up relentlessly. So to see him iced by Tommy Coyle in two rounds was sad to see. I mean, we've seen it over the course of time. In fact, I know I've had criticism in the past for people saying you shouldn't feel guilty for watching boxing, but sometimes when you see a fighter like Katsidis and the fights he's had, and if, like me, you spend a lot of time with fight or have spent a lot of time with fighters who've had long, hard careers down the line, you know, I'm talking about hanging out with fighters who, when they reach the age of 60 or 70, you'll soon find out why I feel guilty about watching boxing sometimes when you've seen Katsidis have those sort of fights, because they don't help you later in life, that's for sure. But now, you know, I just plead with Katsidis to get out while the going's good.
Yeah, I completely agree with everything you said there. The thing is with these guys is you know, you also do speak to them when they're in a horrendous state physically and everything else, and you ask them would they change anything, and 9 times out of 10 their answer is no. They would go back, they would have these wars, they would fight on too long, and they would do it all again. And the thing is with Katsidis as well is that there was no announcement from him, which I was half expecting, afterwards saying, right, that's it, I've reached the end. On his Twitter, there was just a that's boxing kind of comment, hashtag Team Katsidis, which, you know, perhaps suggests that he might want to give it another go.
Hashtag the best is yet to come.
Exactly. It's, you know, you can't, there's nothing you can do to tell these guys to stop. Who are we to tell them to stop when they're doing at this moment in time what they love? But ultimately, it does not breed a happy future.
And the problem is you get anomalies like Bernard Hopkins, like George Foreman, who we'll come on to in a minute, who at the age of 45 and 49 respectively, they set really, really dangerous precedents, in the sense that I've seen and spoken to and heard from countless fighters who will turn around and say, look at Foreman, look at what Foreman did, look at what I do, or, you know, look at what, you know, look at what Hopkins did, that kind of thing. You know, they set these precedents, and other fighters think it becomes the norm, and obviously it hasn't.
I know, but the thing is with that, and it is so common to hear that now. You'll get fighters in their 40s coming back, but Foreman had had a 10-year break. Okay, he had the fight with Ron Lyle, Jimmy Young, the Muhammad Ali, but it wasn't a particularly punishing career first time round. He came back, he fought completely differently, but he had had that break. Bernard Hopkins has fought a different way to the likes of Michael Katsidas throughout his career. However, you do still get fighters like Michael Katsidas, you know, using people like Bernard Hopkins as inspiration. But they're an incredibly small exception.
Can you believe you and I have both spent some time with Iron Barkley over the last few years? And he sadly had a stroke last week. Can you believe he's only 5 years older than Bernard Hopkins?
Well, he doesn't. I mean, the thing that concerned me about Iran Barkley, he's 54. And I think the last time I spent any time with Iran Barkley was about 4 years ago, and his speech was quite slurred. He was not overly steady on his feet. He was overweight. And clearly broke. But a month ago, prior to this stroke, he's in Gleeson's gym telling anybody that will listen that he's coming back. And he's just trying to get himself, and he just wants a promoter to offer him a massive payday to fight. There wouldn't be a promoter in the land that would have given Aaron Barkley a cent to come back, because he's clearly in absolutely no state. But the delusion was running wild.
Yeah, very, very sad. Just while we were on the whole bill, just briefly then, Daniel Brizuela fell to Luke Campbell to set up what looks like a stadium fight next year. Tommy Coyle against Luke Campbell. Stadium worthy? Big fight? It's great for the people of Hull, isn't it? And they'll be there in their masses.
And that's the thing, if a stadium can be filled, then it's stadium worthy. Whether it will kind of generate interest all over the country is something else. I can already hear the criticism for this one being made a pay-per-view bill, but I don't know. I mean, Luke Campbell.
And it's not being made pay-per-view.
No, exactly. But I can just imagine that
the furore that should it happen.
Yeah. But I mean, this to me is it doesn't create the question marks that we spoke about earlier. You know, with Froch, Groves 2, Cleverly, Bellew 2 to a lesser extent, Saunders, Eubank Jr., and even Fury, Chisora 2, to an extent, has got that intrigue, has got that what-if factor. To me, this Campbell and Coyle fight, as I'm sure it will be lapped up in Hull, it doesn't have that intrigue. To me, there's a clear favourite there. And there's an obvious answer when you're searching for who you're going to pick.
Yeah, interesting. And one thing I will mention before we move on, because time is getting on, but Gavin McDonnell has beaten Vusi Malinga on that undercard. We had Gavin McDonnell in the magazine last week. I was pleased to get him in. What a win that is. And there's some news from Gavin McDonnell up on the website today, so guys, check that out. He's come from nowhere, hasn't he, Gavin McDonnell? Talk about being almost the runt of the litter, so to speak. Yeah. You know, because Jamie is obviously two-time world champ, you know, whatever you want to call his belts, two-time champ, decorated fighter, and now Gavin, to his credit, is carved out his own niche and done very well for himself, which isn't easy when you've got such a tough act to follow. But this week, we've got a few minutes left, and I just really wanted to talk about our cover story. Tomorrow marks the 40th anniversary of the Rumble in the Jungle, something that I've just been reading about actually in a new book by Richard Hoffer called Bouts of Mania, a decent book. For me, I enjoyed it. Didn't learn a great deal from it, not much new information in there. They tried to set it up against the social backdrop of the 70s. For me, that aspect of the book didn't work. It was relatively interesting that they tried to do it that way, but obviously the boxing's the interesting part. You know, if I wanted to read a history book about that, I probably would have done. Which reminds me, I probably would like to read a book on the Vietnam War and familiarise myself more with that. But they're talking about the different presidential occupancies in the White House and so forth. not massively relevant when you're talking about Foreman, Frazier and Ali. Not irrelevant, obviously, when you're talking about the political impact of Ali too. But still, we've called it Ali's finest hour this week. Declan Warrington spoken to George Foreman at length. He's spoken to Don King, and I've got a line on that in a minute. And he's spoken to Colin Hart and Alan Hubbard, who were ringsiders there on the night. It's a really interesting feature, very engrossing, captures the mood of Zaire as it was then very, very well. There's plenty of colour in there. One thing that Deck was telling me about his interview with Don King the other day is he said King was going on. He'd gotten talking about Stiverne and Wilder, that fight, and got some lines for a feature for us with Bermain Stiverne. And by near the end of it, Don King says, well, the whole thing's ridiculous anyway. And he said, and do you know what else is ridiculous? The amount of time I've been speaking to you on the phone. And then he just put the phone down. Which, you know, I'm not sure. Deck got what he needed anyway by then, so that was fine. But, King's always called the shots, always had his own agenda, and obviously he had better things to do than speak to Deck by then. But interesting tale nonetheless. Matt, I mean, Zaire, Ali's finest hour, his greatest performance. What does it mean? Well, what does it mean to you?
It's probably the fight I've seen the most, and it is. There's been numerous specials. When I used to work at KOTV, it was featured very, very frequently, both in the weekly program and in the hour classic special.
Let me just put you on the spot. Sorry, who owns the rights to the fight?
It was ESPN, I believe, had the rights to that fight, yeah.
It was part of the big fights catalogue.
Yeah,
in the end.
I never tired of watching it. Ali was absolutely brilliant, the tactics, the courage. But he was, you know, it is a common myth that he took a beating and then all of a sudden George Foreman got tired and knocked Muhammad Ali out. It's just not true. Ali was in control of that fight pretty much from when the opening bell sounded, and he was leading on the cards at the time of the stoppage. The finish for me is, it will still get the hairs on my arms standing up, you know.
Describe that right hand with one word.
Exquisite.
Okay, and then had Foreman and Ali fought a second time after Manila, who would have won?
I would say Ali would have won.
Even after going through what he went through at Manila?
I would say he would have won.
Because Jimmy Young beat Foreman around that time as well.
Yeah, I would say that Ali would have found a way to win, and it would have been ugly, and it would have
tarnished the memories of Zaire probably.
Yeah, I would say Ali would have found a way to win. Foreman at that point, I don't think was that mentally strong. But was it Muhammad Ali's greatest performance? I personally think the first title win over Sonny Liston was his greatest night. But certainly, in terms of fame and everything else, this is the night that Muhammad Ali is probably best remembered for, and that was the Rumble in the Jungle.
Okay, nice thoughts, Matt. And what I want to do really is, because George Foreman's given us such a fantastic interview this week, I'll end on his words. So this is me and Matt signing off. Now imagine me putting on my big big Houston, Texas voice.
Go on then.
But guys, thanks for joining us this week. And these are the final words of George Foreman, spoken to Deck Warrington this week. Pick up the mag and check out the interview and the feature, by all means. But this is from Big George. When asked if he suspects his fight contributed to Ali's condition, later on he says, "You don't like that, losing your friends. I still, in my mind, for some reason, visualise Joe Frazier, Ken Norton still being alive. It's not like life has gotten any better for me without those guys being around. I'm so happy Muhammad is around because I can see pictures of him. I can call his home. It makes me feel good that he's alive and that I'm still alive."